Hey everyone, it's Alex from Alex Company. Today on Dialogue, we are speaking with the very smart and articulate Graham Hall. We've been exploring the disconnect between big data and deep insights and came upon Graham's essay entitled Putting the Analog Back into Insight, which is brilliant, like all of his writing really, because it gives a foundation and grounding for the subject. I want to invite you to spend the next 30 minutes with Tyrone Chikami, who's a contributing planner at Alex Company, and who had the pleasure of speaking with Graham directly on the topic of putting the analog back into insight. Please enjoy, and thanks for listening.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for agreeing to do the interview for Alex Morrow's blog for Dialogues. And
you're welcome.
I just wanted to put a shout out to you. You know, you've had immense experience as a planner and researcher. You were founder of Informer, a youth brand development agency. You're also chief insight officer for Bravo. And for the last 10 years, you've been a consultant for your company, The Insight Edge. Awesome. And, you know, I thought I would read this because I really enjoyed, here's your experience and here's, you know, the length of time you've been doing this for. But then also, like, I thought that this was a great piece of writing. It describes a certain POV of yours, and I just love to read it. It came from your blog, and it was about why you love research. You said, life is amazing, but we never have enough time to think about it. We're too busy dealing with its challenges to sit back and just observe it for a while. But that's what my job gives me. I talk to people. I get them to do silly exercises, they give me their time and considerations, and then I go away and think about what it all meant. And here's the best bit. I'm having breakfast or taking a shower, and in the background, the old CPU is turning over. I might listen to the tapes or draw a few Venn diagrams, and suddenly, bam, the whole thing opens out, as if I've been trying to solve a jigsaw without the box to tell me what the picture is. Then something clicks and I understand why Janice doesn't like to drink red wine or why Phil uses a roll-on rather than a spray, and the pieces start to fit. It all comes down to something about being human that I hadn't noticed before. It's like I found a door to a secret room and now I can go in and look around at the stuff inside. They say the devil is in the detail. But when it comes to insight, the details where the angels live. My job lets me examine those details. I thought that was, you know, a great explanation of your particular POV. And so to start this off, we're interviewing as a series that's playfully called Hey Algorithms Meet Biorhythms. And it's definitely apropos to kind of what you've been discussing in your essay, putting the analog back in insights about, you know, just bouncing out qualitative with in a time there's a lot of quantitative. And so the question I wanted to start off with is, you know, definitely just a definition for you. When you say analog in that essay, and when you start to discuss analog research, what do you mean by that?
Well, I guess I'm using analog slightly playfully as a juxtaposition against digital, because it is, you know, in modern parlance, you've got your digital and then you've got your analog. And within music circles, for example, we talk about analog as being vinyl and digital as being, you know, all things like in the old days, CDs and downloading tracks and ripping tracks. So in a very, you know, in a very general sense, I'm just juxtaposing other data against digital data. Mm-hmm. But it does go deeper than that, and in a way, because analog itself is an analog. An analog is something that is a representation of something else. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I started writing that essay about, you know, getting back to analog, I spent quite a long time thinking about, well, what is analog? What is analog thinking? And it took me to some interesting scientific places. You know, you have to really understand, I mean, I'm sure there's many people more knowledgeable about this than I am, but sure. It's all about, digital is really binary. It's on and off. Mm-hmm. Everything we see digitally is really just a whole sequence of ones and zeros, mm-hmm. Made infinitely complex by the way it's delivered. Mm-hmm. And we can reinterpret that into music, pictures, data, the way people respond to ads on their websites. That's all digital, and it's all fundamentally based on and off, yes and no, yeah. One and zero, black and white. Analog, if you think about analog in music terms, you look like you're somebody who might be into music. You know, there's something beautiful about vinyl records. Mm. People say they're warm. You can actually hear the artist more clearly, and with all its imperfections, it's got a certain, the pops and the crackles give that rendering of the music more warmth and depth and ultimately humanity. Mm. When you juxtapose that with digital can feel very cold and kind of too clinical. You're losing some of the humanity from the music when it's placed into a digital format. Yeah. So I, you know, analog, however, you know, quite strictly speaking, analog is really just still a representation of the real thing. It's not the real thing, mm-hmm. but it's so much more real than a digital interpretation. Mm-hmm. An analog wave is digital is on and off. Analog is a wave. Mm-hmm. And within that wave, there is an infinite number of pieces of information being delivered mm-hmm. in a much more subtle and nuanced way than perhaps black and white, the black and white of digital. I get very, very pretentious talking about this stuff. So. But it's really interesting.
Those are the things that popped up for me when I thought about the word analog and the way that you're using it, and especially towards, you know, kind of qualitative interviews and qualitative research and more voice of the consumer approaches, you know, the idea that it's warmer and you get more than just yes or no. How did that, you know, as you described that, how did you arrive upon, how did it become necessary for you? When did it become necessary for you to start talking about this and start to really kind of put your stake in the ground and say that this was important and this is being overlooked?
I would say I started thinking about that in approximately 1984, 1985, let's say, when I started out in my career. I started off in market research at the August Taylor Nelson that became Taylor Nelson Software and has become, you know, part of the WPP empire. Mm. I started there coding responses. Mm-hmm. This is pre-computers. We're talking about cards here, coding cards mm-hmm. with little holes in them that a computer can read. And you have a code frame when you do that. And I use this technique now. People have forgotten this technique. People don't know what this technique is anymore, I don't think. Mm-hmm. I tell people about this. It's the most simple thing you can possibly do, but people are like, wow, that's amazing. So what you do is you basically have a code frame, which is 1 to 10. And then there was an X, Y, and Z at the end, Z at the end. And you would read all of these open-ended questions and say, okay, that question, the answer to that question that somebody had filled in on a paper questionnaire, they're talking about this. They're talking about, I don't know, how white the shirt collars get for using that particular soap powder. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about how it also makes the fabric softer. So you had two things there. They answered in one answer, but there were two things in that answer. Gotcha. And you have to break out those two things into this code frame. So code one might be whiter clothes. Code two might have been softer fabric. Mm-hmm. And you had to break that out. Now, these days, that would just be whiter clothes, because nobody human is reading that thing and saying there were two things in there. There were two elements to why she liked that washing up powder. Mm-hmm. And just in that moment, you see, when you reduce it to digital, you're losing so much of the context and the texture and the, you know, the warmth of this person trying to explain to you why she liked that product. It wasn't just nice black and white answer. It was a nuanced, more complicated answer. Yeah. So right back in 1985, when I was sitting in this room in the outskirts of London, dimly lit, I might say, reading these questionnaires and coding them, I thought, my gosh, we reduce people so quickly to numbers. we reduced their answers so quickly to make it convenient for us to understand what they were saying. And in doing so, you were losing so much of the subtlety. And not just the subtlety of the answer, but the way that respondent was trying to explain. Because in understanding how she was trying to explain her experiences, you could see how her brain was working,
yeah.
What her hierarchy of interests were. And all of that is lost with your digital answers. So I don't know if that answers the question. It was a long answer.
No, I'm liking it. And it has so much to it. And especially not, I think sometimes, especially with insights and stuff, there can be a move to sometimes say, well, sometimes to reduce things, you know, a spark point that opens things up as a way of looking at things dynamically. But to bring it back to you and the way that you see things, it sounds like that analog, this going back to analog, is a correction to maybe an overemphasis on digital. Can you tell us the issue you have with the way that big data is being used right now?
Big data, as I try and explain in that essay, it pervades the way we think. It reduces the options we allow ourselves to engage with. And it reduces things from subtle answers to very simplistic answers. It's also very behavioral. Data tends to measure what has happened. It's really, really bad at predicting what might happen. And, when you're looking in the rearview mirror, to use Marshall McLuhan's phrase, you can't see what's coming up. You can't predict, you can't surprise. You know, it's very difficult to explain how a joke works. You know, Freud and Jung spent a lot of time trying to understand how jokes worked. And why they work is because they concluded a joke will take you down a route and then it will change course at the last moment. So you're thinking, okay, I know where this is going. And then suddenly it takes, you turn sharp right. And that's funny. I don't know why that's funny, but it is funny. Because it kind of shows up that the world doesn't show up like you expect it to. Now, if you just followed the big data route and followed the answers that that provides, you'd end up doing the predictable things. It is predictable. Yeah, the algorithms are not great at throwing up the randomness, which makes life interesting. It's the spice of life. And who wants to be like everybody else? We all want to be different. We all want to at least feel we have a degree of individuality about us. And what happens with big data is it will constantly throw up the obvious, the safe answer, the predictable answer. And actually, it's a human being's DNA. It's within our DNA to want to be different from everybody else. So it's not like I hate big data. And I think I say in my essay all along, it's always useful, but it's not the whole answer. And you're missing that kind of spark if you don't also have within your data inputs a hefty chunk of that analog, surprising analog stuff in there as well.
It also seemed to me with reading the essay is that leaning too much on big data, and you're right, it is a useful thing and it has been useful. Possibly people are exploring the convention, but it leads people to be inferring rather than verifying. Would you say that? What would you say about that? Like, you know, people are using the data to infer things about people rather than discover things about people.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, I guess we look at that data and it works in many other subtle ways too. It makes you feel superior because you can look at all this data. It's like you have this godlike quality because you're looking down on all of the behavior of all these people, and it puts you on this pedestal, which is also hugely, hugely problematic, because unless you are a human and you can relate to your hopeful customer, who hopefully will become your customer, unless you can relate to them on a human level, you will miss that opportunity to connect with them. Mm-hmm. You're just doing things to them rather than engaging with them. Yeah. And the kind of the way in which using big data, it kind of conditions your brain into being somewhat more aloof and distant from the subject matter. It works in subtle ways beyond just sense the false sense of certainty it offers.
Yeah, exactly. And I just sent you that email that you can't always trust the numbers. You know, to put it mildly, you know, that does seem like it could be a really big pitfall. Talk to us about, I would love to know about your recent work. And you just recently finished a campaign for Christopher Ward watches. Yeah. and you were using a more of an analog approach. Tell us how you were applying that and how it worked and what surprised you.
Well, it didn't surprise me because it's how I've worked forever. Christopher Ward, great watches, great value, brilliant quality at surprisingly low prices given how good they are made. And they do that because they sell over the internet. It's a direct market model. And that means that they have tons of data. Mm-hmm. You know, they can look at their Google Analytics up the yin yang and figure out who's doing what where and why. But when you actually scratch beneath the surface, there's very little knowledge and understanding of who these people are. Mm-hmm. So when I got involved with them 2.5 years ago, or whatever it was, we just spent a lot of time talking to people whenever we could and with whomever we could. And I don't know how many focus groups I've conducted over the years, mm-hmm. all over the world. All kinds of places and all sorts of subjects. And it's a big logistical undertaking and it's costly to do that. And a lot of the time, you're looking at these people in these 90-minute focus groups or 2-hour focus groups or 3-hour creative groups or a whole day workshops we're doing. And you think, there's so much about that person I don't know. And I bet they've got some really interesting stories they could tell me if only we had the chance to talk. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying focus groups are wrong, but there is something very, very, very powerful sitting down with somebody with a cup of coffee in there over the kitchen table and watching how they interact with their family, looking at their house, have them relate to you like they're a normal human being and trust you to talk in conversational terms, in a relaxed manner. If you're any good at doing this job, you crack a few jokes, they feel comfortable telling you stuff, and you get to know so much more.
Sure.
And it doesn't cost very much money. It's not rock. I say to everybody, it's not rocket science. And they all say, yeah, but it is rocket science because you've been doing, it's not rocket science. Are you any good? Are you a human being? If you're a human being, just go and talk to people and listen to what they want to tell you. It's enough. There's a myth even within the qualitative industry about, oh, we do this, that, and the other. Oh man, it's a lot simpler than we think it is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I wonder if you know, a lot of the big data and the big data analytics, I wonder if this convention is because sometimes we're sometimes afraid to ask people what they think.
We need to sort of, you know, if we're going to ask our client for big bucks, we've got to be doing more than just having a talk with somebody. Mm. I don't sure that's, you know, yeah. I tell you something else that I noticed last week, before Christmas, actually, I was doing this really great job talking to people about why they have open fires in their homes, coal fires, log burners, all of that stuff.
Oh, wow.
It was a gas doing that job because you sat there, literally next to the fire, talking about, well, how do you burn? Where do you get your wood from? Really stupid, simple questions. Yeah. And nothing they said surprised me. I could understand I could have figured out what they were going to tell me because it's not that complicated. But when we sat down and we talked about it and we, you know, it was at, well, I won't talk about the caveman kind of ideas that we used to sit around as human beings in caves lighting fires. So there's something very deep in our psyche about fires. There's that going on. Mm. But there's also a whole bunch of other things which I can't actually tell you about because it's confidential, but that came out. And it didn't necessarily hit me while I was sat there talking to him. It was, as you say, I was having a shower or something. And I thought, whoa, I was probably looking at the fire. Also, a very good meditative technique when you're trying to figure out what your consumers are saying. Sit in front of your fire and watch the flames. Your mind's got to just wander. And you go, oh, God, of course. There's something, there was a thread running through all of our conversations, which was complete news to my client when I delivered it to him last week. And I kind of knew going up to see them, they're going to be blown away by this. And they were, because we found something really obvious. It was hiding in plain sight. It didn't take rocket science. It just took you to do the process properly and dwell on what people were saying. And then all of the kind of superficial stuff just disappeared and you're left with the thing. Yeah, I guess that takes skill. I guess that takes experience.
But it also sounds like it's something very, very far away, you know, very far away. It would be very difficult to touch if you were relying on people to click on things on their computer to engage with their...
You would never, ever get that, ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sure that there are other people listening out here who are, who, as you say, are kind of like the people who are pressed to churn out insights, you know, on a digital budget in through digital conventions, and they may be missing something or they may be curious. How would you, what would you tell people about how to implement more analog stuff in their work?
So the digital convention has caused us to try and compress the whole process. The process, digital has made expectations of how quickly and how inexpensively we can get to data that we can work with. And one of the drawbacks of analog or qualitative data is it does take quite a lot of time compared to digital. And it does cost more money. It's not, this is information that isn't lying around in spreadsheets somewhere. You've got to go out and mine the data in the real world. So that's why I was talking about that 5-2-1 thing. That is just a process for tasting what analog can do. It's the foot in the door. It's the way of saying, look how much richer we are now, just with this piece of information. Imagine if we did that over a year. I believe in iteration. I believe in us constantly learning. I believe in us creating a partnership with the client where we are all of us together on the journey of learning and enriching and deepening and coming up with hypotheses and then throwing them away and moving forward, never thinking that you've got to the answer, because the answer is never, you will never get to the answer, because as soon as you've got to the answer, it will change the dynamics of what it was that you were looking at in the first place. So, it's like a relationship, like every relationship. You have to keep refreshing the relationship. If you think that you know everything about your partner, they're going to get boring. But if you think they're always changing, you're always changing, you're coming across new ways of interacting, it keeps it fresh. And I think that that's the way we should regard our relationships with our consumers, our customers, our friends, our, these people that we partner with. The whole of that, all the language is wrong too, by the way. We still use consumer and customer completely wrong.
What words would you use?
Well, I still use people, to be honest. I still use customers and consumers quite a lot. But we should try. The process of doing what I'm doing brings everybody closer together, so our customers cease to be just these people we interact with financially. They're much more our partners. We have a shared set of values. People who buy Christopher Ward watches have a set of values, which which kind of we and they share those values to a degree. So, I've gone off on one.
That's okay. And, you know,
I was talking about that, the compression. The problem with analog is that clients, they're kind of used to having, you know, a deck arrive the next morning, because you can just type in a few things in your computer, pull out the data, and think you've got the insights. Mm-hmm. And by comparison, analog takes longer, probably costs a bit more. But if you can keep the price down and do it quick, you can at least show how much more rich you are for having done the exercise.
Yeah, yeah. Don't be respectful, respectful of your time. I'm wondering, you know, as just as a final question, analog brings in this dimension of meaning. Can you talk? Can you say something to that? What's the value that meaning adds to a campaign? You know, to reaching people.
Ultimately, marketing is about people. It's about people connecting with people. It's really seductive to think that we are in control of these dials and levers, and that we're somehow, as marketers, we're controlling people. But people don't want to be controlled. They have lives outside of your brand. They really couldn't care less about your brand. If you're not going to actually be meaningful to them, there's 1,000 other things they can be doing with their lives. And it's getting more and more acute that is the case. Mm-hmm. We are really only trying to connect with humans who are not necessarily rational people. Mm-hmm. That we are emotional animals. We have many things going on in our lives which we are barely in control of. Mm-hmm. So to believe that these subjects that we are engaged with are in some way rational and making well thought through decisions is completely false, actually. The analogy I use is, you know, it's like these supercomputers that are getting better at predicting the weather. We can predict the weather 2 weeks out to some degree. Mm-hmm. I mean, about 10, 20 years ago, it was only a week out. Now we're getting up to 2 weeks out. After that, there's so many variables, it all goes completely off the scale, and there's very little knowledge. You know, people in Florida will tell you this, they have no idea when the next hurricane's coming in, because we for all the supercomputers we have, we can't understand that. I would suggest that trying to understand what's going to happen with the human condition from 1 week to the next is about 20 times more complex than understanding what the weather's like. So if you think your supercomputer is going to figure out where consumers are going to be in a month, good luck to you, because you haven't got a Scooby-Doo, as we say in the UK.
Well, I mean, I haven't.
Phrase over here now is that he hasn't got a Scooby, which means he doesn't have an idea. Anyway, if you believe that you can predict where the consumer is going to be in a month, then you are deluded. And there's no way of you finding that out. So the only way we can engage with a world that is that degree of chaotic is to use all of our intuition, all of our senses, all of our best guesses, which we actually neuroscientists don't understand how that works either. Mm-hmm. But we're a smart species. We can figure stuff out through intuition. That is how we should be progressing in our marketing. Much more intuition, much more gathering of that soft data, much more understanding who that consumer is, much more mapping that consumer onto your own experiences and saying, how would that make me feel? Because that allows you to start projecting, okay, I think if that were me, I'd be doing this. And you start building a picture in that way. It's not scientific, but it's probably more accurate.
Thank you so much. You've given me so much to think about.
And I've enjoyed talking to you, Tyro.
So good talking to you. I appreciate so much.
You're welcome.
Anyways, thank you so much for having this conversation. Hope to talk to you soon. And thank you so much.
Yeah, cool. Well, send my regards to Alex, and I'll speak to you soon.
Okay, you take care, Graham. Peace.